Disc 2.
The Idle House of Astarte. And now, Dr. Pender, what are you going to tell us? The old clergyman smiled gently. My life has been passed in quiet places, he said. Very few eventful happenings have come my way. Yet once, when I was a young man, I had one very strange and tragic experience. Ah, said Joyce Lompierre encouragingly. I have never forgotten it, continued the clergyman. It made a profound impression on me at the time, and to this day, by a slight effort of memory, I can feel again the awe and horror of that terrible moment when I saw a man stricken to death by apparently no mortal agency. You make me feel quite creepy, Pender, complained Sir Henry. Made me feel creepy, as you call it, replied the other. Since then, I have never laughed at the people who use the word atmosphere. There is such a thing. There are certain places imbued and saturated with good or evil influences which can make their power felt. That house, the Larches, is a very unhappy one, remarked Miss Marple. Old Mr. Smithers lost all his money and had to leave it, and then the Carslakes took it, and Johnny Carslake fell downstairs and broke his leg, and Mrs. Carslake had to go away to the south of France for her health. And now the Burdens have got it. And I hear that poor Mr. Burden has got to have an operation almost immediately. There is, I think, rather too much superstition about such matters, said Mr. Petherick. A lot of damage is done to property by foolish reports heedlessly circulated. I have known one or two ghosts that have had a very robust personality, remarked Sir Henry with a chuckle. I think, said Raymond, that we should allow Dr. Pender to go on with his story. Joyce got up and switched off the two lamps, leaving the room lit only by the flickering firelight. Atmosphere, she said. Now we can get along. Dr. Pender smiled at her, and leaning back in his chair and taking off his pince-nez, he began his story in a gentle, reminiscent voice. I don't know whether any of you know Dartmoor at all. The place I'm telling you about is situated on the borders of Dartmoor. It was a very charming property, though it had been on the market without finding a purchaser for several years. The situation was perhaps a trifle bleak in winter, but the views were magnificent, and there were certain curious and original features about the property itself. It was bought by a man called Hayden, Sir Richard Hayden. I'd known him in his college days, and though I'd lost sight of him for some years, the old ties of friendship still held. And I accepted with pleasure his invitation to go down to Silent Grove, as his new purchase was called. The house party was not a very large one. There was Richard Hayden himself and his cousin, Elliot Hayden. There was a Lady Mannering with a pale, rather inconspicuous daughter called Violet. There was a Captain Rogers and his wife, hard-riding, weather-beaten people who lived only for horses and hunting. There was also a young Dr. Simons, and there was Miss Diana Ashley. I knew something about the last named. Her picture was very often in the society papers, and she was one of the notorious beauties of the season. Her appearance was indeed very striking. She was dark and tall, with a beautiful skin of an even tint of pale cream, and her half-closed dark eyes set slantways in her head, gave her a curiously piquant, oriental appearance. She had, too, a wonderful speaking voice, deep-toned and bell-like. I thought once that my friend Richard Hayden was very much attracted by her, and I guess that the whole party was merely arranged as a setting for her. Of her own feelings I was not so sure. She was capricious in her favours. One day talking to Richard and excluding everyone else from her notice, and another day she would favour his cousin, Elliot, and appear hardly to notice that such a person as Richard existed. And then again she would bestow the most bewitching smiles upon the quiet and retiring Dr. Simons. On the morning after my arrival, our host showed us all over the place. The house itself was unremarkable, a good, solid house built of Devonshire granite, built to withstand time and exposure. It was unromantic, but very comfortable. From the windows of it one looked out over the panorama of the moor, vast rolling hills crowned with weather-beaten tors. On the slopes of the tor nearest to us were various hut circles, relics of the bygone days of the late Stone Age. On another hill was a barrow which had recently been excavated and in which certain bronze implements had been found. Hayden was by way of being interested in antiquarian matters, and he talked to us with a great deal of energy and enthusiasm. This particular spot, he explained, was particularly rich in relics of the past. Neolithic hut dwellers, Druids, Romans, and even traces of the early Phoenicians were to be found. "But this place is the most interesting of all," he said. "You know its name, Silent Grove." "Well, it's easy enough to see what it takes its name from." He then pointed with his hand. That particular part of the country was bare enough, rocks, heather, and bracken. But about 100 yards from the house, there was a densely planted grove of trees. "That is a relic of very early days," said Hayden. "The trees have died and been replanted, but on the whole it has been kept very much as it used to be. Perhaps in the time of the Phoenician settlers. Come and look at it." We all followed him. As we entered the grove of trees, a curious oppression came over me. I think it was the silence. No birds seemed to nest in those trees. There was a feeling about it of desolation and horror. I saw Hayden looking at me with a curious smile. "Any feeling about this place, Pender?" he asked me. "Antagonism now, or uneasiness?" "I don't like it," I said quietly. "You're within your rights. This was a stronghold of one of the ancient enemies of your faith. This is the grove of Astarte." "Astarte?" "Astarte, or Ishtar, or Ashtoreth, or whatever you choose to call her. I prefer the Phoenician name of Astarte. There is, I believe, one known grove of Astarte in this country, in the north, on the wall. I have no evidence, but I like to believe that we have a true and authentic grove of Astarte here. Here, within this dense circle of trees, sacred rites were performed." "Sacred rites," murmured Diana Ashley. Her eyes had a dreamy, faraway look. "What were they, I wonder?" "Not very reputable, by all accounts," said Captain Rogers, with a loud, unmeaning laugh. "Rather hot stuff, I imagine." Hayden paid no attention to him. "In the centre of the grove there should be a temple," he said. "I can't run to temples, but I have indulged in a little folly of my own." We had at that moment stepped out into the little clearing in the centre of the trees. In the middle of it was something not unlike a summer house made of stone. Diana Ashley looked inquiringly at Hayden. "I call it the Idol House," he said. "It is the Idol House of Astarte." He led the way up to it. Inside, on a rude ebony pillar, there reposed a curious image representing a woman with crescent horns seated on a lion. "Astarte of the Phoenicians," said Hayden, "the goddess of the moon." "The goddess of the moon," cried Diana. "Oh, do let's have a wild orgy tonight. Fancy dress, and we'll come out here in the moonlight and celebrate the rites of Astarte." I made a sudden movement, and Elliot Hayden, Richard's cousin, turned quickly to me. "You don't like all this, do you, Padre?" he said. "No," I said gravely, "I don't." He looked at me curiously. "But it's only tomfoolery. Dick can't know that this really is a sacred grove. It's just a fancy of his. He likes to play with the idea. And anyway, if it were..." "If it were?" "Well," he laughed uncomfortably, you don't believe in that sort of thing, do you? You, a parson?" "I am not sure that as a parson I ought not to believe in it. But that sort of thing is all finished and done with." "I am not so sure," I said musingly. "I only know this. I am not, as a rule, a sensitive man to atmosphere. But ever since I entered this grove of trees, I felt a, a curious impression and sense of evil and menace all round me. He glanced uneasily over his shoulder. "Yes," he said, "yes, it is queer somehow. I know what you mean, but I suppose it's only our imagination makes us feel like that. What do you say, Simons?" The doctor was silent a minute or two before he replied, and he said quietly, "I don't like it. I can't tell you why, but somehow or other I don't like it." At that moment Violet Mannering came across to me. "I hate this place," she cried. "I hate it. Do let's get out of it." We moved away, and the others followed us. Diana Ashley lingered. I turned my head over my shoulder and saw her standing in front of the idol house, gazing earnestly at the image within it. The day was an unusually hot and beautiful one, and Diana Ashley's suggestion of a fancy dress party that evening was received with general favour. The usual laughing and whispering and frenzied secret sewing took place, and when we all made our appearance for dinner, there were the usual outcries of merriment. Rogers and his wife were Neolithic hut dwellers, explaining the sudden lack of hearth rugs. Richard Hayden called himself a Phoenician sailor, and his cousin was a brigand chief. Dr. Simons was a chef. Lady Mannering was a hospital nurse, and her daughter was a Circassian slave. I myself was arrayed somewhat too warmly as a monk. Diana Ashley came down last, and was something of a disappointment to us all, being wrapped in a shapeless black domino. "The unknown," she declared airily. "That is what I am. Now, for goodness sake, let's go into dinner." After dinner, we went outside. It was a lovely night, warm and soft, and the moon was rising. We wandered about and chatted, and the time passed quickly enough. It must have been an hour later when we realized that Diana Ashley was not with us. "Surely she's not gone to bed," said Richard Hayden. Violet Mannering shook her head. "Oh, no," she said. "I saw her going off in that direction about a quarter of an hour ago." She pointed as she spoke towards the grove of trees that showed black and shadowy in the moonlight. "I wonder what she's up to," said Richard Hayden. "Some devilment, I swear. Let's go and see." We all trooped off together, somewhat curious as to what Miss Ashley had been up to. Yet I, for one, felt a curious reluctance to enter that dark, foreboding belt of trees. Something stronger than myself seemed to be holding me back, urging me not to enter. I felt more definitely convinced than ever of the essential evilness of the spot. I think that some of the others experienced the same sensations that I did, though they would have been loath to admit it. The trees were so closely planted that the moonlight could not penetrate. There were a dozen soft sounds all round us, whisperings and sighings. The feeling was eerie in the extreme, and by common consent we all kept close together. Suddenly we came out into the open clearing in the middle of the grove and stood rooted to the spot in amazement. For there, on the threshold of the idol house, stood a shimmering figure, wrapped tightly round in diaphanous gauze and with two crescent horns rising from the dark masses of her hair. "My God," said Richard Hayden, and the sweat sprang out on his brow. But Violet Mannering was sharper. "Why, it's Diana," she exclaimed. "What has she done to herself? Oh, she looks quite different somehow." The figure in the doorway raised her hands. She took a step forward and chanted in a high, sweet voice. "I am the priestess of Astarte," she crooned. "Beware how you approach me, for I hold death in my hand." "Don't do it, dear," protested Lady Mannering. "You give us the creeps, you really do." Hayden sprang forward towards her. "My God, Diana," he cried, "you are wonderful." My eyes were accustomed to the moonlight now, and I could see more plainly. She did, indeed, as Violet had said, look quite different. Her face was more definitely oriental, and her eyes more of slits with something cruel in their gleam, and the strange smile on her lips was one that I had never seen there before. "Beware," she cried warningly. "Do not approach the goddess. If anyone lays a hand on me, it is death." "'You're wonderful, Diana,' cried Hayden, "'but do stop it. "'Somehow or other, I don't like it.' "'He was moving towards her across the grass, "'and she flung out a hand towards him. "'Stop!' she cried. "'One step nearer, and I'll smite you with the magic of Astarte.' "'Richard Hayden laughed and quickened his pace. "'When all at once a curious thing happened, "'he hesitated for a moment.' Then seemed to stumble and fall headlong. He didn't get up again, but lay where he had fallen, prone on the ground. Suddenly Diana began to laugh hysterically. It was a strange, horrible sound breaking the silence of the glade. With an oath, Elliot sprang forward. "'I can't stand this,' he cried. "'Get up, Dick. Get up, man.' But still Richard Hayden lay where he had fallen. Elliot Hayden reached his side, knelt by him and turned him gently over. He bent over him, peering into his face. Then he rose sharply to his feet and stood swaying a little. "'Doctor,' he said. "'Doctor, for God's sake, come. I think he's dead.' Simon ran forward, and Elliot rejoined us, walking very slowly. He was looking down at his hands in a way I didn't understand. At that moment there was a wild scream from Diana. "'I've killed him!' she cried. "'Oh, my God! I didn't mean to, but I've killed him!' And she fainted dead away, falling in a crumpled heap on the grass. There was a cry from Mrs. Rogers. "'Oh, do let's get away from this dreadful place!' she wailed. "'Anything might happen to us here. Oh, it's awful!' Elliot got hold of me by the shoulder. "'It can't be, man,' he murmured. "'I tell you, it can't be. "'A man can't be killed like that. "'It's against nature.' "'I tried to soothe him. "'There is some explanation,' I said. "'Your cousin must have had some unsuspected weakness of the heart, "'the shock and excitement,' he interrupted me. "'You don't understand,' he said. "'He held up his hands for me to see, "'and I noticed a red stain on them. "'Dick didn't die of shock. "'He was stabbed.' "'Stabbed at the heart, and there's no weapon.' "'I stared at him incredulously. "'At that moment, Simons rose from his examination of the body "'and came towards us. "'He was pale and shaking all over. "'Are we all mad?' he said. "'What is this place? "'The things like this can happen in it.' "'Then it is true,' I said. "'He nodded. "'The wound is such as would be made by a long, thin dagger, but... "'There's no dagger there.' "'We all looked at each other. "'But it must be there,' cried Elliot Hayden. "'It must have dropped out. "'It must be on the ground somewhere. "'Let's look.' "'We peered about vainly on the ground. "'Violet Mannering said suddenly, "'Diana had something in her hand, the kind of dagger. "'I saw it. "'I saw it glitter when she threatened him.' "'Elliot Hayden shook his head.' "'He never even got within 3 yards of her,' he objected. "'Lady Mannering was bending over the prostrate girl on the ground. "'There's nothing in her hand now,' she announced. "'I can't see anything on the ground. "'Are you sure you saw it, Violet?' "'I didn't.' "'Dr. Simons came over to the girl. "'We must get her to the house,' he said. "'Rogers, will you help?' "'Between us we carried the unconscious girl back to the house.' Then we returned and fetched the body of Richard. Dr. Pender broke off apologetically and looked round. "'One would know better nowadays,' he said, "'owing to the prevalence of detective fiction. "'Every street boy knows that a body must be left where it is found. "'But in those days we had not the same knowledge, "'and accordingly we carried the body of Richard Hayden "'back to his bedroom in the square granite house, "'and the butler was dispatched on a bicycle in search of the police.' A ride of some 12 miles. It was then that Elliot Hayden drew me aside. "'Look here,' he said, "'I'm going back to the grove. "'That weapon has got to be found.' "'If there was a weapon,' I said doubtfully. "'He seized my arm and shook it fiercely. "'You've got that superstitious stuff in your head. "'You think his death was supernatural. "'Well, I'm going back to the grove to find out.' "'I was curiously averse to his doing so.' I did my utmost to dissuade him, but without result. The mere idea of that thick circle of trees was abhorrent to me, and I felt a strong premonition of further disaster. But Elliot was entirely pig-headed. He was, I think, scared himself, but he wouldn't admit it. He went off fully armed with determination to get to the bottom of the mystery. It was a very dreadful night. None of us could sleep or attempt to do so. The police, when they arrived, were frankly incredulous of the whole thing. They evinced a strong desire to cross-examine Miss Ashley, but there they had to reckon with Dr. Simons, who opposed the idea vehemently. Miss Ashley had come out of her faint or trance, and he had given her a strong sleeping draught. She was on no account to be disturbed until the following day. It was not until about 7 o'clock in the morning that anyone thought about Elliot Hayden. And then Simon suddenly asked where he was. I explained what Elliot had done, and Simon's grave face grew a shade graver. I wish he hadn't. It's foolhardy, he said. You don't think any harm can have happened to him? I hope not. I think, Padre, that you and I had better go and see. I knew he was right, but it took all the courage in my command to nerve myself for the task. We set out together and entered once more that ill-fated grove of trees. We called him twice and got no reply. In a minute or two we came into the clearing, which looked pale and ghostly in the early morning light. Simons clutched my arm, and I uttered a muttered exclamation. Last night, when we had seen it in the moonlight, there had been the body of a man lying face downwards on the grass. Now, in the early morning light, the same sight met our eyes. Elliot Hayden was lying on the exact spot where his cousin had been. "My God," said Simons, "it's got him too." We ran together over the grass. Elliot Hayden was unconscious but breathing feebly, and this time there was no doubt of what had caused the tragedy. A long, thin bronze weapon remained in the wound. "Got him through the shoulder, not through the heart. That's lucky," commented the doctor. "On my soul, I don't know what to think. At any rate, he's not dead, and he'll be able to tell us what happened." But that was just what Elliot Hayden was not able to do. His description was vague in the extreme. He had hunted about vainly for the dagger, and at last, giving up the search, had taken up a stand near the idol house. It was then that he became increasingly certain that someone was watching him from the belt of trees. He fought against this impression, but was not able to shake it off. He described a cold, strange wind that began to blow. It seemed to come not from the trees, but from the interior of the idol house. He turned round, peering inside. He saw the small figure of the goddess, and he felt that he was under an optical delusion. The figure seemed to grow larger and larger. Then he suddenly received something that felt like a blow on his temple, which sent him reeling back. And as he fell, he was conscious of a sharp burning pain in his left shoulder. The dagger was identified this time as being the identical one which had been dug up in the barrow on the hill, and which had been brought by Richard Hayden. Where he had kept it, in the house or in the idol house in the grove, none seemed to know. The police were of the opinion, and always will be, that he was deliberately stabbed by Miss Ashley. But in view of our combined evidence that she was never within 3 yards of him, they could not hope to support the charge against her. So the thing has been, and remains, a mystery. There was a silence. "There doesn't seem anything to say," said Joyce Lomprier at length. "It's all so horrible and uncanny. Have you no explanation yourself, Dr. Pender?" The old man nodded. "Yes," he said, "I have an explanation, a kind of explanation, that is. Rather a curious one, but to my mind it still leaves certain factors unaccounted for." "I have been to seances," said Joyce, "and you may say what you like. Very queer things can happen. I suppose one can explain it by some kind of hypnotism. The girl rarely turned herself into a priestess of Astarte, and I suppose somehow or other she must have stabbed him. Perhaps she threw the dagger that Miss Mannering saw in her hand." "Or it might have been a javelin," suggested Raymond West. After all, moonlight is not very strong. She might have had a kind of spear in her hand and stabbed him at a distance. And then I suppose mass hypnotism comes into account. I mean, you were all prepared to see him stricken down by supernatural means, and so you saw it like that. I have seen many wonderful things done with weapons and knives at music hall, said Sir Henry. I suppose it's possible that a man could have been concealed in the belt of trees, and that he might from there have thrown a knife or a dagger with sufficient accuracy, agreeing, of course, that he was a professional. I admit that that seems rather far-fetched, but it seems the only really feasible theory. You remember the other man was distinctly under the impression that there was someone in the grove of trees watching him. As to Miss Mannering saying that Miss Ashley had a dagger in her hand and the other saying she hadn't, well, that doesn't surprise me. If you'd had my experience, you would know that five persons' account of the same thing will differ so widely as to be almost incredible. Mr. Petherick coughed. But in all these theories we seem to have overlooked one essential fact, he remarked. What became of the weapon? Miss Ashley could hardly get rid of a javelin, standing as she was in the middle of an open space. And if a hidden murderer had thrown a dagger, the dagger would still have been in the wound when the man was turned over. We must, I think, discard all far-fetched theories and confine ourselves to sober fact. And where does sober fact lead us? Well, one thing seems quite clear. No one was near the man when he was stricken down, so the only person who would have stabbed him was he himself. Suicide, in fact. But why on earth should he wish to commit suicide? Asked Raymond West incredulously. The lawyer coughed again. Well, that is a question of theory once more, he said. At the moment, I'm not concerned with theories. It seemed to me, excluding the supernatural, in which I do not for one moment believe, that that was the only way things could have happened. He stabbed himself and he fell. His arms flew out, wrenching the dagger from the wound and flinging it into the zone of the trees. That is, I think, although somewhat unlikely, a possible happening. I don't like to say, I'm sure, said Miss Marple. It all perplexes me very much indeed, but curious things do happen. At Lady Sharpley's garden party last year, the man who was arranging the clock golf tripped over one of the numbers. Quite unconscious he was, and didn't come round for about 5 minutes. Yes, dear aunt, said Raymond gently, but he wasn't stabbed, was he? Of course not, dear, said Miss Marple. That is what I'm telling you. Of course, there's only one way that poor Sir Richard could have been stabbed, but I do wish I knew what caused him to stumble in the first place. Of course, it might have been a tree root. He would have been looking at the girl, of course, and when it's moonlight, one does trip over things. You say that there is only one way that Sir Richard could have been stabbed, Miss Marple, said the clergyman, looking at her curiously. It's very sad. I don't like to think of it. But he was a right-handed man, was he not? I mean, to stab himself in the left shoulder, he must have been. I was always so sorry for Jack Baines in the war. He shot himself in the foot, you'll remember, after very severe fighting at Arras. He told me about it when I went to visit him in the hospital, and very ashamed of it he was. I don't expect this poor man, Elliot Hayden, profited much by his wicked crime. Elliot Hayden, cried Raymond, you think he did it? I don't see how anyone else could have done it, said Miss Marple, opening her eyes in gentle surprise. I mean, as if Mr. Petherick so wisely says, one looks at the facts and disregards all that atmosphere of heathen goddesses, which I don't think is very nice. He went up to him first and turned him over, and of course to do that he would have had to have his back to them all. And being dressed as a brigand chief, he would be sure to have a weapon of some kind in his belt. I remember dancing with a man dressed as a brigand chief when I was a young girl. He had five kinds of knives and daggers, and I can't tell you how awkward and uncomfortable it was for his partner. All eyes were turned towards Dr. Pender. I knew the truth, he said, 5 years after that tragedy occurred. It came in the shape of a letter written to me by Elliot Hayden. He said in it that he fancied that I'd always suspected him. He said it was a sudden temptation. He too loved Diana Ashley, but he was only a poor, struggling barrister. With Richard out of the way and inheriting his title and estates, he saw a wonderful prospect opening up before him. The dagger had jerked out of his belt as he knelt down by his cousin, and almost before he had time to think, he drove it in and returned it to his belt again. He stabbed himself later in order to divert suspicion. He wrote to me on the eve of starting on an expedition to the South Pole in case, as he said, he should never come back. I do not think that he meant to come back, and I know that, as Miss Marple has said, his crime profited him nothing. For 5 years, he wrote, I have lived in hell. I hope at least that I may expiate my crime by dying honourably. There was a pause. And he did die honourably, said Sir Henry. You change the names in your story, Dr. Pender, but I think I recognise the man you mean. As I said, went on the clergyman, I do not think that explanation quite covers the facts. I still think there was an evil influence in that grove, an influence that directed Elliot Hayden's action. Even to this day I can never think without a shudder of the idle house of Astarte. Motive versus opportunity. Mr. Petherick cleared his throat rather more importantly than usual. I'm afraid my little problem will seem rather tame to you all, he said apologetically. After the sensational stories we've been hearing, there's no bloodshed in mine, but it seems to me an interesting and rather ingenious little problem, and fortunately I'm in the position to know the right answer to it. It isn't terribly legal, is it? Asked Joyce. I mean, points of law on lots of Barnaby versus Skinner in the year 1881 and things like that. Mr. Petherick beamed appreciatively at her over his eyeglasses. No, no, my dear young lady, you need have no fears on that score. The story I'm about to tell is a perfectly simple and straightforward one, and can be followed by any layman. No legal quibbles now, said Miss Marple, shaking a knitting needle at him. Certainly not, said Mr. Petherick. Ah, well, I'm not so sure, but let's hear the story. It concerns a former client of mine. I'll call him Mr. Claude, Simon Claude. He was a man of considerable wealth, and lived in a large house not very far from here. He had had one son killed in the war, and this son had left one child, a little girl. Her mother had died at her birth, and on her father's death she had come to live with her grandfather, who at once had become passionately attached to her. Little Chris could do anything she liked with her grandfather. I have never seen a man more completely wrapped up in a child, and I cannot describe to you his grief and despair when, at the age of 11... the child contracted pneumonia and died. Poor Simon Claude was inconsolable. A brother of his had recently died in poor circumstances, and Simon Claude had generously offered a home to his brother's children, two girls, Grace and Mary, and a boy, George. But though kind and generous to his nephew and nieces, the old man never expended on them any of the love and devotion he had accorded to his little grandchild. Employment was found for George Claude in a bank nearby, and Grace married a clever young research chemist of the name of Philip Garrod. Mary, who was a quiet, self-contained girl, lived at home and looked after her uncle. She was, I think, fond of him in her quiet, undemonstrative way, and to all appearances things went on very peacefully. I may say that after the death of little Christabel, Simon Claude came to me and instructed me to draw up a new will. By this will, his fortune, a very considerable one, was divided equally between his nephew and nieces, a third share to each. Time went on. Chancing to meet George Claude one day, I inquired for his uncle, whom I had not seen for some time. To my surprise, George's face clouded over. Oh, I wish you could put some sense into Uncle Simon, he said ruefully. His honest but not very brilliant countenance looked puzzled and worried. This spirit business is getting worse and worse. What spirit business? I asked, very much surprised. Then George told me the whole story, how Mr. Claude had gradually got interested in the subject, and how on the top of this interest he had chanced to meet an American medium, a Mrs. Eurydice Spragg. This woman, whom George did not hesitate to characterise as an out-and-out swindler, had gained an immense ascendancy over Simon Claude. She was practically always in the house, and many seances were held in which the spirit of Christabel manifested itself to the doting grandfather. I may say here and now that I do not belong to the ranks of those who cover spiritualism with ridicule and scorn. I am, as I have told you, a believer in evidence, and I think that when we have an impartial mind and weigh the evidence in favour of spiritualism, there remains much that cannot be put down to fraud or lightly set aside. Therefore, as I say, I am neither a believer nor an unbeliever. There is certain testimony with which one cannot afford to disagree. On the other hand, spiritualism lends itself very easily to fraud and imposture, and from all young George Claude told me about this Mrs. Eurydice Spragg, I felt more and more convinced that Simon Claude was in bad hands, and that Mrs. Spragg was probably an impostor of the worst type. The old man, shrewd as he was in practical matters, would be easily imposed on where his love for his dead grandchild was concerned. Turning things over in my mind, I felt more and more uneasy. I was fond of the young Claudes, Mary and George, and I realised that this Mrs. Spragg and her influence over their uncle might lead to trouble in the future. At the earliest opportunity, I made a pretext for calling on Simon Claude. I found Mrs. Spragg installed as an honoured and friendly guest. As soon as I saw her, my worst apprehensions were fulfilled. She was a stout woman of middle age, dressed in a flamboyant style, very full of cant phrases about our dear ones who have passed over, and other things of the kind. Her husband was also staying in the house, Mr. Absalom Spragg, a thin, lank man with a melancholy expression and extremely furtive eyes. Soon as I could, I got Simon Claude to myself and sounded him tactfully on the subject. He was full of enthusiasm. Eurydice Spragg was wonderful. She'd been sent to him directly in answer to prayer. She cared nothing for money. The joy of helping a heart in affliction was enough for her. She had quite a mother's feelings for little Chris. Then he went on to give me details. How he had heard his Chris's voice speaking, how she was well and happy with her father and mother. He went on to tell other sentiments expressed by the child, which in my remembrance of little Christabel seemed to be highly unlikely. She laid stress on the fact that father and mother loved dear Mrs. Spragg. But of course he broke off, "You're a scoffer, Petherick." "No, I am not a scoffer. Very far from it. Some of the men who have written on the subject are men whose testimony I would accept unhesitatingly, and I should accord any medium recommended by them respect and credence. I presume that this Mrs. Spragg is well vouched for." Simon went into ecstasies over Mrs. Spragg. She'd been sent to him by heaven. He had come across her at the watering place where he had spent 2 months in the summer. A chance meeting, but with what a wonderful result. I went away very dissatisfied. My worst fears were realised, but I didn't see what I could do. After a good deal of thought and deliberation, I wrote to Philip Garrard, who, as I had mentioned, just married the eldest Claude girl, Grace. I set the case before him, of course in the most carefully guarded language. I pointed out the danger of such a woman gaining ascendancy over the old man's mind. And I suggested that Mr. Claude should be brought into contact, if possible, with some reputable spiritualistic circles. This, I thought, would not be a difficult matter for Philip Garrard to arrange. Garrard was prompt to act. He realised, which I did not, that Simon Claude's health was in a very precarious condition, and as a practical man he had no intention of letting his wife or her sister and brother be despoiled of the inheritance which was so rightly theirs. He came down the following week, bringing with him as a guest no other than the famous Professor Longman. Longman was a scientist of the first order, a man whose association with spiritualism compelled the latter to be treated with respect. Not only a brilliant scientist, he was a man of the utmost uprightness and probity. The result of the visit was most unfortunate. Longman, it seemed, had said very little while he was there. Two seances were held. Under what conditions, I do not know. Longman was non-committal all the time he was in the house. But after his departure, he wrote a letter to Philip Garrard. In it, he admitted that he had not been able to detect Mrs. Sprague in fraud. Nevertheless, his private opinion was that the phenomena was not genuine. Mr. Garrard, he said, was at liberty to show this letter to his uncle if he thought fit, and he suggested that he himself should put Mr. Claude in touch with a medium of perfect integrity. Philip Garrard had taken this letter straight to his uncle, but the result was not what he had anticipated. The old man flew into a towering rage. It was all a plot to discredit Mrs. Sprague, who was a maligned and injured saint. She had told him already what bitter jealousy there was of her in this country. He pointed out that Longman was forced to say he had not detected fraud. Eurydice Sprague had come to him in the darkest hour of his life and given him help and comfort, and he was prepared to espouse her cause, even if it meant quarrelling with every member of his family. She was more to him than anyone else in the world. Philip Garrard was turned out of the house with scant ceremony. But as a result of his rage, Claude's own health took a decided turn for the worse. For the last month he had kept to his bed pretty continuously, and now there seemed every possibility of his being a bedridden invalid until such time as his death should release him. 2 days after Philip's departure, I received an urgent summons and went hurriedly over. Claude was in bed and looked, even to my layman's eye, very ill indeed. He was gasping for breath. "This is the end of me," he said. "I feel it. Don't argue with me, Patrick. But before I die, I'm going to do my duty by the one human being who has done more for me than anyone else in the world. I want to make a fresh will." "Certainly," I said. "If you will give me your instructions now, I'll draft out a will and send it to you." "That won't do," he said. "Why, man, I might not live through the night. I've written out what I want here," he fumbled under his pillow, "and you can tell me if it's right." He produced a sheet of paper with a few words roughly scribbled on it in pencil. It was quite clear and simple. He left £5,000 to each of his nieces and nephew, and the residue of his vast property outright to Eurydice Sprague, in gratitude and admiration. I didn't like it, but there it was. There was no question of unsound mind. The old man was as sane as anybody. He rang the bell for two of the servants. They came promptly. The housemaid, Emma Gaunt, was a tall, middle-aged woman who had been in service there for many years and who had nursed Claude devotedly. With her came the cook, a fresh, buxom young woman of 30. Simon Claude glared at them both from under his bushy eyebrows. "I want you to witness my will. Emma, give me my fountain pen." Emma went over obediently to the desk. "Not that left-hand drawer, girl," said old Simon irritably. "Don't you know? It's in the right-hand one." "No, it's here, sir," said Emma, producing it. "Then you must have put it away wrong last time," grumbled the old man. I can't stand things not being kept in their proper places." Still grumbling, he took the pen from her and copied his own rough draft, amended by me, onto a fresh piece of paper. Then he signed his name. Emma Gaunt and the cook, Lucy David, also signed. I folded the will up and put it into a long blue envelope. It was necessarily, you understand, written on an ordinary piece of paper. Just as the servants were turning to leave the room, Claude lay back on the pillows with a gasp and distorted face. I bent over him anxiously, and Emma Gaunt came quickly back. However, the old man recovered and smiled weakly. "It's all right, Petherick. Don't be alarmed. At any rate, I shall die easy now I've done what I wanted to." Emma Gaunt looked inquiringly at me, as if to know whether she could leave the room. I nodded reassuringly, and she went out, first stopping to pick up the blue envelope which I had let slip to the ground in my moment of anxiety. She handed it to me, and I slipped it into my coat pocket. and then she went out. "You're annoyed, Petherick," said Simon Clode. "You're prejudiced, like everybody else." "It's not a question of prejudice," I said. "Mrs. Spragg may be all that she claims to be. I should see no objection to you leaving her a small legacy as a memento of gratitude. But I tell you frankly, Clode, that to disinherit your own flesh and blood in favour of a stranger is wrong." With that, I turned to depart. I had done what I could and made my protest. Mary Clode came out of the drawing-room and met me in the hall. "You will have tea before you go, won't you? Come in here." And she led me into the drawing-room. A fire was burning on the hearth, and the room looked cosy and cheerful. She relieved me of my overcoat just as her brother George came into the room. He took it from her and laid it across a chair at the far end of the room. Then he came back to the fireside where we drank tea. During the meal, a question arose about some point concerning the estate. Simon Clode said he didn't want to be bothered with it and had left it to George to decide. George was rather nervous about trusting to his own judgment. At my suggestion, we adjourned to the study after tea, and I looked over the papers in question. Mary Clode accompanied us. A quarter of an hour later, I prepared to take my departure. Remembering that I had left my overcoat in the drawing-room, I went there to fetch it. The only occupant of the room was Mrs. Spragg, who was kneeling by the chair on which the overcoat lay. She seemed to be doing something rather unnecessary to the cretonne cover. She rose with a very red face as we entered. "That cover never did set right," she complained. "My, I could make a better fit myself." I took up my overcoat and put it on. As I did so, I noticed that the envelope containing the will had fallen out of the pocket and was lying on the floor. I replaced it in my pocket, said goodbye, and took my departure. On arrival at my office, I will describe my next actions carefully. I removed my overcoat and took the will from the pocket. I had it in my hand and was standing by the table when my clerk came in. Somebody wished to speak to me on the telephone, and the extension to my desk was out of order. I accordingly accompanied him to the outer office and remained there for about 5 minutes, engaged in conversation over the telephone. When I emerged, I found my clerk waiting for me. "Mr. Spragg has called to see you, sir. I showed him into your office." I went there to find Mr. Spragg sitting by the table. He rose and greeted me in a somewhat anxious manner, and then proceeded to a long, discursive speech. In the main, it seemed to be an uneasy justification of himself and his wife. He was afraid people were saying, etc., etc. His wife had been known from her babyhood upwards for the pureness of her heart and her motives, and so on and so on. I was, I'm afraid, rather curt with him. In the end, I think he realized that his visit was not being a success, and he left somewhat abruptly. I then remembered that I had left the will lying on the table. I took it, sealed the envelope, and wrote on it, and put it away in the safe. Now I come to the crux of my story. 2 months later, Mr. Simon Clode died. I will not go into long-winded discussions, I will just state the bare facts. When the sealed envelope containing the will was opened, it was found to contain a sheet of blank paper. He paused, looking round the circle of interested faces. He smiled himself with a certain enjoyment. "You appreciate the point, of course. For 2 months the sealed envelope had lain in my safe. It could not have been tampered with then. No, the time limit was a very short one between the moment the will was signed and my locking it away in the safe. Now, who had the opportunity, and to whose interests would it be to do so? I will recapitulate the vital points in a brief summary. The will was signed by Mr. Clode, placed by me in an envelope. So far, so good. It was then put by me in my overcoat pocket. That overcoat was taken from me by Mary and handed by her to George, who was in full sight of me whilst handling the coat. During the time that I was in the study, Mrs. Eurydice Spragg would have had plenty of time to extract the envelope from the coat pocket and read its contents, and, as a matter of fact, finding the envelope on the ground and not in the pocket seemed to point to her having done so. But here we come to a curious point. She had the opportunity of substituting the bank paper, but no motive. The will was in her favour. And by substituting a blank piece of paper, she despoiled herself of the heritage she'd been so anxious to gain. The same applied to Mr. Spragg. He, too, had the opportunity. He was left alone with the document in question for some 2 or 3 minutes in my office. But again, it was not to his advantage to do so. So we are faced with this curious problem. The two people who had the opportunity of substituting a blank piece of paper had no motive for doing so, and the two people who had a motive had no opportunity. By the way, I would not exclude the housemaid, Emma Gaunt, from suspicion. She was devoted to her young master and mistress and detested the Spraggs. She would, I feel sure, have been quite equal to attempting the substitution if she had thought of it. But although she actually handled the envelope when she picked it up from the floor and handed it to me, she certainly had no opportunity of tampering with its contents. She could not have substituted another envelope by some sleight of hand, which anyway she would not be capable, because the envelope in question was brought into the house by me, and no one there would be likely to have a duplicate. He looked round, beaming, on the assembly. Now, that is my little problem. I have, I hope, stated it clearly, and I should be interested to hear your views. To everyone's astonishment, Miss Marple gave vent to a long and prolonged chuckle. Something seemed to be amusing her immensely. "What's the matter, Aunt Jane? Can't we share the joke?" said Raymond. "I was thinking of little Tommy Simons, a naughty little boy, I'm afraid, but sometimes very amusing. One of those children with innocent, childlike faces who are always up to some mischief or other. I was thinking how last week in Sunday school he said, 'Teacher, do you say yolk of eggs is white or yolk of eggs are white?' And Miss Durston explained that anyone would say, 'Yolks of eggs are white,' or 'yolk of egg is white.' And naughty Tommy said, 'Well, I should say, yolk of egg is yellow.' Very naughty of him, of course, and as old as the hills. I knew that one as a child." "Very funny, my dear Aunt Jane," Raymond said gently, "but surely that has nothing to do with the very interesting story that Mr. Petherick has been telling us." "Oh, yes, it has," said Miss Marple. "It's a catch. And so is Mr. Petherick's story a catch. So like a lawyer. Ah, my dear old friend." And she shook her approving head at him. "I wonder if you really know," said the lawyer with a twinkle. Miss Marple wrote a few words on a piece of paper, folded them up and passed them across to him. Mr. Petherick unfolded the paper, read what was written on it, and looked across at her appreciatively. "My dear friend," he said, "is there anything you do not know?" "I knew that as a child," said Miss Marple. "I played with it too." "I feel rather out of this," said Sir Henry. "I feel sure that Mr. Petherick has some clever legal legerdemain up his sleeve." "Not at all," said Mr. Petherick. "Not at all. It is a perfectly fair, straightforward proposition. You mustn't pay any attention to Miss Marple. She has her own way of looking at things." "We should be able to arrive at the truth," said Raymond West, a trifle vexedly. "Facts certainly seem plain enough. 5 persons actually touched that envelope. The Spraggs clearly could have meddled with it, but equally clearly they did not do so. Now, there remains the other 3. When one sees the marvellous ways that conjurers have of doing a thing before one's eyes, it seems to me that the paper could have been extracted and another substituted by George Claude during the time he was carrying the overcoat to the far end of the room." "Well, I think it was the girl," said Joyce. "I think the housemaid ran down, told her what was happening, and she got hold of another blue envelope and just substituted the one for the other." Sir Henry shook his head. "I disagree with you both," he said slowly. These sort of things are done by conjurers, and they are done on the stage and in novels, but I think they would be impossible to do in real life, especially under the shrewd eyes of a man like my friend Mr. Petherick here. But I have an idea. It's only an idea, nothing more. We know that Professor Longman has just been down for a visit, and that he said very little. It's only reasonable to suppose that the Spraggs may have been very anxious as to the result of that visit. If Simon Clode didn't take them into his confidence, which is quite probable, they may have viewed his sending for Mr. Petherick from quite another angle. They may have believed that Mr. Clode had already made a will which benefited Eurydice Spragg, and that this new one might be made for the express purpose of cutting her out as a result of Professor Longman's revelations. Or, alternatively, as the lawyers say, Philip Garrard had impressed on his uncle the claims of his own flesh and blood. In that case, suppose Mrs. Spragg prepared to effect a substitution. This she does, but Mr. Petherick coming in at an unfortunate moment, she had no time to read the real document, and hastily destroys it by fire in case the lawyer should discover his loss. Joyce shook her head very decidedly. Oh, no, she'd never burn it without reading it. The solution is rather a weak one, admitted Sir Henry. I suppose Mr. Petherick didn't assist Providence himself. The suggestion was only a laughing one, but the little lawyer drew himself up in offended dignity. A most improper suggestion, he said with some asperity. What does Dr. Pender say? Asked Sir Henry. I cannot say that I have any very clear ideas. I think the substitution must have been effected by either Mrs. Spragg or her husband, possibly for the motive that Sir Henry suggests. If she did not read the will until after Mr. Petherick had departed, she would then be in somewhat of a dilemma, since she couldn't own up to her action in the matter. Possibly she would place it among Mr. Clode's papers, where she thought it would be found after his death. Why it wasn't found, I don't know. It might be a mere speculation, this, that Emma Gaunt came across it, and out of misplaced devotion to her employers, deliberately destroyed it. I think Dr. Pender's solution is the best of all, said Joyce. Is it right, Mr. Petherick? The lawyer shook his head. I'll go on where I left off. I was dumbfounded, and quite as much at sea, as all of you are. I don't think I should ever have guessed the truth, probably not, but I was enlightened. It was cleverly done, too. I went out and dined with Philip Garrard about a month later, and in the course of our after-dinner conversation, he mentioned an interesting case that had recently come to his notice. I should like to tell you about it, Petherick. In confidence, of course. Quite so, I replied. A friend of mine who had expectations from one of his relatives was greatly distressed to find that the relative had thoughts of benefiting a totally unworthy person. My friend, I'm afraid, is a trifle unscrupulous in his methods. There was a maid in the house who was greatly devoted to the interests of what I may call the legitimate party. My friend gave her very simple instructions. He gave her a fountain pen duly filled. She was to place this in a drawer in the writing table in her master's room, but not the usual drawer where the pen was generally kept. If her master asked her to witness his signature to any document, and asked her to bring him his pen, she was to bring him not the right one, but this one, which was an exact duplicate of it. That was all she had to do. He gave her no other information. She was a devoted creature, and she carried out his instructions faithfully. He broke off and said, "Oh, I hope I'm not boring you, Petherick." "Not at all," I said. "I'm keenly interested." Our eyes met. "My friend is, of course, not known to you," he said. "Of course not," I replied. "Then that's all right," said Philip Garrard. He paused, then said smilingly, "You see the point? The pen was filled with what is commonly known as evanescent ink. A solution of starch in water to which a few drops of iodine have been added. This makes a deep blue-black fluid, but the writing disappears entirely in 4 or 5 days. Miss Marple chuckled. Disappearing ink, she said. I know it. Many is the time I've played with it as a child. And she beamed round on them all, pausing to shake a finger once more at Mr. Petherick. But all the same, it's a catch, Mr. Petherick, she said. Just like a lawyer.
End of Disc 2.